Thinking Like a Mountain is the title of our Earth Day program and of the piece we'll listen to next. Its composer is Victoria Bond. She studied composition with Ingolf Dahl, and she studied singing at the University of Southern California before attending the Juilliard School, where she studied composition with Roger Sessions and Vincent Persichetti, and conducting with Jean Morel, Sixten Ehrling, and Herbert von Karajan. She was the first woman to be awarded the doctorate in conducting at Juilliard. She made her American debut at Alice Tully Hall, New York, in 1973. In 1978, Bond became conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony and has since balanced her time between conducting and composing. She has served as music director of the Roanoke Symphony and Opera Roanoke in Virginia and the New Amsterdam Symphony and the Bel Canto Opera Company in New York City. Her compositions have been performed throughout the United States, in Europe, Asia, and South America, and she has been invited to guest conduct orchestras around the world. She has been commissioned by many prestigious organizations, such as the Houston Symphony, the Shanghai Symphony, and the American Ballet Theater. Before we listen to Thinking Like a Mountain for narrator and orchestra, come and listen into a conversation I recorded with Victoria Bond earlier today. Unfortunately, there are some audio problems in this interview, and we apologize for this, but I want you to hear this, so please bear with us in terms of audio. Hello, Victoria Bond, and welcome into the light, as we say.
Thank you.
We are looking forward to listening to Thinking Like a Mountain in a few minutes, and looking forward to having you tell us a little bit about the piece.
Very good.
Why don't you just start at the beginning, and actually I'm interested in, tell our radio listeners about the piece, because I was saving that for you. It's a piece for orchestra and narrator. How did the idea or the commission come about in the first place?
Well, the idea for the piece came about because American environmentalist Leopold.
Mm-hmm.
I was very moved by his writing, kind of a contemporary Thoreau, even though he's no longer alive. Still, he lived within fairly modern times, and yet his writing has the kind of timelessness of a Thoreau. And I am an outdoors person. I love to hike, and I love mountains. And I wanted to make a musical portrait of a mountain, which did not have to do with sound effects or even suggestions of wind or water. What I wanted to do was to represent the various time scales of communities that live on the mountain. And by that, I mean, for example, the time scale of the rocks that comprise the mountain itself would be measured in eons.
Mm-hmm.
And centuries and actually thousands of years, millennia. The trees on the mountain could be measured in hundreds of years or in decades. The animal life on the mountain could be measured in decades or years. The insect life would be as short as a few days, and
mm-hmm.
Perhaps some plant life would be even one day. And so there were all of these different intersecting time scales. And as a musician, I find that very, very fascinating, that all of these different scales were intersecting at certain points, and yet each of them had their own consistency. And so that's what I attempted to do in music. Of course, we have the tools in augmentation and diminution, and the whole idea of a fugue is that of the same material happening at different times and intersecting,
yeah.
And intersecting in different ways. So it seemed like an intrinsically musical idea. It wasn't too much of a stretch to translate it from a theoretical idea or an abstract idea into an idea that could be expressed by notes. So that is basically the overall structure of the piece. Of course, a lot of the piece has to do with the story itself. The essay, Thinking Like a Mountain, is a particular moment of revelation in Aldo Leopold's life, when he went from being someone who basically used nature, because he was a hunter before this, to somebody who served nature. So it was like a complete about-face for him. And that moment of truth happened when he shot a wolf, actually a whole pack of wolves, a female and her litter of cubs. And he realized at the moment that he did this that he had violated a very major law, and he felt it. He felt it so deeply, and he expressed it so eloquently. He talks about the green fire dying in the eyes of the old wolf that he shoots. And it's such a powerful and touching moment.
It is a powerful image. And you had read this, and this is what inspired you really to write this?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, very much so. The commission and the nature of the thematic material are also very much linked, because it was commissioned by Shanghai Symphony. And I had been to China to conduct that orchestra a year and a half earlier, and I had been introduced to a piece of Chinese music called A Thousand Birds Worshipping the Phoenix. And it was the most beautiful melody, and it just seemed to have that kind of timeless quality of nature. And so I decided to use that as the thematic material of the piece. It has a kind of an ascending fourths, which was very simple, very beautiful, and just left a lot of room for all sorts of musical twistings and turnings, I would say.
Right. You mentioned fugal writing before. Is there an actual fugue in the piece?
Oh, yes, yes. There are many fugues. The most obvious one is when the pups are playing. It's a scene where the hunter first encounters them, and there's this joyous scene of them meeting. They've all come from different directions, and they're all meeting and playing together. And so there's a fugue that begins that, and then it goes into an augmentation, which for me kind of visually was representative of a camera close in, and then pulling back and pulling back until you really have kind of a helicopter shot, as it were, of these playful creatures from a great distance away.
Well, that's fascinating. It brings up an interesting to me. Are we as listeners to try to hear these things? How do you want people to listen to this music, in particular because there's narration going on? Should we focus on the music, or shall we focus on the narration and have the music as a sort of enhancement and background and something that provides an atmosphere? Or shall we shift back and forth between them?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. In my own listening to pieces, the first pass-through is often quite different than subsequent hearings. And I really like a piece that offers itself up in different ways at different times of your life and in different, perhaps, times that you hear the piece. When you first approach a piece, you may be most interested in the story, or you may be most interested in the music. So there's no proper way to listen to it. Hopefully there are enough elements in the piece that whatever you need the most at the moment, it's sort of the stem cell theory, you know. It's whatever you happen to need at the moment that will feed. And so I would say that hopefully the piece will yield different things in different hearings, so that it's got enough richness to it that it doesn't necessarily, you don't have to feel that you're not listening to it properly if you
right.
don't get it in its entirety on the first hearing. As a matter of fact, I'd prefer it if there were more to hear each time you listened.
Well, I can certainly recommend that experience, as I have listened to it several times, the music more and more each time, which is really beautiful and very expressive. I hear wolf sounds and all kinds of things
yes,
going on.
Yes, there are wolf sounds. You know, the thing I love so much, many things. One thing is, they're such musical creatures. I mean, how can you not love animals that get together to sing?
You know, right.
I mean, that's really such, for a musician, I can't think of anything better. And I rode away to Wolf Central in Minnesota. Actually, there is such a place, and
Wolf
I don't think
Central.
It's called Wolf Central, but there is a wolf hotline.
Uh-huh.
And I sent away for for various CDs of Wolf's Howling.
Oh.
And it's so fascinating the way they interplay. And so string instruments can imitate that actually rather well. So there is a Wolf's Howling section in the piece.
The fact that wolves get together to sing is such a marvelous thing. That's part of their social activity. And how can you not love animals that that enjoy singing together? I just think as a musician, it's thrilling. And their songs are so interesting, too, because they have this long kind of mournful, descending glissando that they sing at many, many different pitches and volumes. And of course, I'm sure in the open where they're coming, the sounds are coming from many different areas, it's really very fascinating.
Did you listen to these?
Of course, on the CD, you can only hear it fairly one-dimensionally, but I could imitate that very nicely in the strings with the glissandos and the strings. So you do hear wolves.
Right. Did you listen to the recordings of the wolves before you wrote the piece?
Yes, very much so. I really, as a matter of fact, I took dictation from some of the CDs, so I tried to get as close to the actual sounds as possible.
Well, it's a wonderful musical result, and this has been so interesting to hear about. And we thank you very, very much for coming on Into the Light to let us know about it.
Well, a pleasure to speak with you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Thanks.
In the performance we'll be listening to, the Shanghai Symphony Orchestra is featured with Kui Wen narrating and Victoria Bond conducting. Because the Chinese narrator takes some adjusting on our part to understand, I'm going to read a portion from the middle of the text, which forms the crux of the essay. Aldo Leopold is relating the episode which changed his life, the day he saw a wolf die. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. Since then, I have lived to see state after state extirpate its wolves. I have watched the face of many a wolfless mountain and seen the south-facing slopes wrinkle with a maze of new deer trails. I have seen every edible bush and seedling browsed to anemic desuetude and then to death. I have seen every edible tree defoliated to the height of a saddle horn. Such a mountain looks as if someone had given God a new pruning shears and forbidden him all other exercise. In the end, the starved bones of the hoped-for deer herd, dead of its own too much, bleach with the bones of the dark sage or molder under the highline junipers. I now suspect that just as a deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer. So also with cows. The cowman who cleans his range of wolves does not realize that he is taking over the wolf's job of trimming the herd to fit the range. He has not learned to think like a mountain. Hence we have dust bowls and rivers washing the future into the sea. And now let's hear Thinking Like a Mountain.